This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
When the World Trade Towers fell, President George Bush advised Americans what to do. Go shopping. If we don't keep filling our lives with an endless parade of stuff, we all know what happens. Anarchy and famine. But the emissions, the waste, the pollution, we are shopping the planet to death and we know it. Can we ever escape these consumer lives? So a few years ago, I interviewed Canadian journalist J.B. McKinnon about his co-authored book, and that became a movement, The 100-Mile Diet, A Year of Local Eating. Now he's back with his latest book, The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves, from Vancouver, Canada. James McKinnon, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be back here.
Well, of course, the whole world needs to keep making and buying stuff. We can't stop, except for a brief moment in time, we just did. James, what did we learn from the pandemic shutdowns?
I think we learned some extraordinary things. We learned that if we stop consuming at such a high rate, we get bluer skies. We get clearer stars in the night sky. We get a very abrupt and deep drop in carbon emissions. We start to see a resurgence in the vitality of the natural world. And we also saw some really dramatic changes in ourselves. We immediately started making sure that we had contact with our family and friends. We really saw what was vitally important to us during the pandemic. We started to pursue things like creative expression and personal excellence. And there, it was really dramatic how quickly all of that came about.
Well, those are things you cannot buy, obviously. I wonder, though, did online shopping grow to the same level as previous in-store shopping, or does going virtual result in somewhat less consumerism?
No, I mean, really, over the whole span of the pandemic, we saw people make a turn back towards consumerism. It's what we know best, and we reinvented it for the pandemic circumstances. So we did see, in fact, an increase in the sale of goods, for example. There was a steep decline in the purchase of services because we simply couldn't access those. We replaced that, I suppose, with the consumption of goods and with the consumption of watchables. We streamed more than we have ever streamed before on online.
You know, we recently did a show about degrowth. You literally searched the world to find what a deconsumer society could look like. Why don't you give us the example that you found in Japan? And that's a country that's known for its shopping and luxury brands.
Yeah, what's happening in Japan right now is remarkable. They've really gone about 30 years without much growth to speak of. There's been brief periods of growth, but for the most part, their economy has been in something like a steady state. I ended up going to an island called Sado Island. It's a place that not only has seen degrowth, but has seen serious depopulation. So it's lost about half of its population. And that gives you a window into what would happen if we drew down consumption by a significant degree. And what you see there is simply the reinvention of society, not its collapse, but its reinvention. You see people turning towards more self-provisioning in their lives, often growing their own food or organizing daycare for their children, things like that, creating their own forms of entertainment. You saw a shift from big resort-style tourism to smaller-scale tourism, small-scale restaurants. To some people, it's heaven, and to some people, it's not what they're looking for. You know, they want the high excitement and the thrills of downtown Tokyo. The difference being that what's going on in Sado Island is profoundly sustainable, and what's happening in downtown Tokyo is not.
So if you had to choose maybe the top few most damaging things about this consumer economy, what would you tell people about?
Well, I would certainly say that climate change is powerfully driven by consumption. Carbon emissions track very closely with GDP, and the GDP, of course, is driven by consumerism. But, I mean, it really extends to everything. Consumerism pervades the way we eat. It pervades the effect we have on forests, on water. You name an environmental problem, and consumption is a powerful driver of that. But I would also say that some of the worst effects are upon ourselves. You know, we are driven more and more to be consumers rather than, for example, participants. As I took note in the book of the world's largest experiment in participatory culture just outside of London, England, it was really affecting to see what happens when people have an opportunity to participate in all kinds of activities in their daily lives that are beyond the earn and spend cycle, as compared to lives that are consumed by consumption.
So there are people, both in distant cultures, but right around here, looking for alternatives. And what sort of pathways can we find?
What I really concluded through this search around the globe for examples of glimpses, I suppose, of what post-consumer society might look like is that we need to build this. It's not a question of making changes so much in our personal lives. We've seen through history movements towards simpler living, towards decluttering, towards voluntary simplicity and downshifting. These things have come and gone, and it seems really difficult to have them stick and endure for very long within the framework of consumer society. What we can do is start to transform that society itself so that lower consumption is built into it. And then we get the benefits of a lower consuming society without each of us having to struggle through it as an individual choice.
We want to think that continuing disasters, and we do have them, will persuade people to wake up and change their consumer ways. But in the book, you quote retired anthropologist Richard Wilk, and he said this about consumerism: it thrives in situations of instability and contradiction, on social disruption and individual mobility as resource depletion ravages this planet. I wonder, are we going to soothe our troubles by shopping even more? Is shopping now a rebellious act?
It's a really counterintuitive idea, but materialism really kicks in when we feel like our material security is under threat. I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense. You want to have materialist values. You want to get out there and sort out how you're going to put food on the table and a roof over your head when you feel your material existence is actually threatened. You know, this points towards solutions like greater equality of opportunity in employment, greater equality in the distribution of income. These sorts of things that give more people more security are actually what can help us draw down consumption as well.
Your book took me to something that I have never understood reading the Wall Street Journal or any other financial media, and that is that there's going to be some people who are going to work hard and produce things on the other side of the world. And then here in the wealthy countries, our job is to buy things. And so 70% of our economy is consumerism. But really, that just sounds nuts. I mean, there's no God-given right for one part of the planet to work and the other part of the planet to get all the stuff. I don't see how that can continue. And I guess it's not continuing.
I agree. I mean, it's fundamentally unfair. I talked to the CEO of a manufacturing plant for clothing in Bangladesh, and I mean, he points out that, you know, it's not the Bangladeshis who are polluting their own nation or driving down wages or flooding cities through the effects of climate change. It's consumers elsewhere that are having those kinds of impacts and placing those kinds of pressures on Bangladeshi society. And it was really striking to me to talk to him and hear that perspective, because maybe we've tried to convince ourselves that at best, you know, the people who are making the products that we use aren't making the link to our direct responsibility in Western society for these social and environmental consequences. But pretty clearly they are.
I think that's growing, and we're just going to see more of that. Getting closer to home, a friend of mine, he had to divorce his wife because her whole day consisted of going from one shop to another, buying things they didn't need and building up huge bills they really couldn't pay, and divorce ended up being the way out. I wonder if we'll need a new field of counseling for deprogramming shopaholics, or if you prefer, compulsive buying disorder.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think what's interesting about it is that the process of learning about consumption and how deeply ingrained it is actually made me more compassionate, I suppose, towards people's shopping habits, because it's a consumer society, it's a consumer economy, and there's these very powerful forces that compel us to consume. $600 billion advertising industry. We see right now government stimulus intended to get us back to the malls and buying things and taking flights, and you know, the prices set by big businesses, the interest rates set by central banks. I mean, all of these things are designed to get us out there and spending. So, you know, it's not something where I really think there's a ton of value in making individual consumers feel terrible and guilty about doing exactly what so many powerful forces are driving them to do. I think it's really this question of starting to look at the system itself and how we can make changes in the system that will make it easier for all of us to consume less. Most people would agree that a lot of the consumption we do isn't providing much to our quality of life in the richer countries. They may feel sparks of joy, as they say, from purchasing and repurchasing and buying more and more, but it's not accumulating into deep satisfaction or enduring happiness for very many people at this point.
So you bought a $50 broom.
I did. Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things with this was realizing that being thrifty isn't always the way to consume less. I think we kind of conflate those two things, but some people are thrifty and they buy enormous numbers of goods. So I started experimenting with this idea of, you know, buying fewer but better things, better quality things. And a $50 broom was one of those. And so I bought a handmade broom made by local artisans here in Vancouver, quite a bit more than a broom I might have bought at Walmart, but imbued with all kinds of values that are important to me. You know, I was able to hand my money over to people who, you know, I can pop by their store anytime and see them. It's repairable, and they're happy to do that for me. It's high quality. It sweeps like a dream. And it's very long lasting. So, I mean, I'll have this broom for 20 years, perhaps, or more. So I started, you know, through this process, changing my own consumption habits. I still am interested in buying things secondhand and so on, but moving to this concept of buying fewer but better things allows us to have surround ourselves. If we're going to have objects surrounding ourselves, then why not let them be beautiful products that are wonderful to use?
So when people get afraid of a crash, or actually experience one personally, what are the first items cut from spending, and what do most people see as truly indispensable, which I assume is apparently toilet paper?
So toilet paper is definitely a clear winner. It's actually really difficult to say. I mean, I looked at this for the United States in the Great Recession. There's a number of things that are pretty clear. People will stop buying new cars, basically big ticket items fall away pretty quickly because people don't want to gamble that much money. But beyond a certain point, people are very idiosyncratic. I mean, we're all individuals. We have very individual ways of consuming, and what's important to one person can be utterly insignificant to another. But what I do think is maybe more interesting in things like crashes is that you do see people move towards things that help them with self-provisioning. So gardening supplies, things that they use for cooking. You do see people acquiring different products that let them get out into the great outdoors, that let them get out and get healthy with their bodies, because often during the crash, a lot of us have more time to spend doing things for ourselves. And this, of course, is one of the, you know, the great lessons of a deconsumer society, is that we do trade off goods, services, and experiences to some extent, but what we get in exchange is a lot more free time that we can invest. And what people often invest that free time in is relationships, particularly relationships with friends and family and even strangers, but also in relationships with the natural world.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is journalist and author J.B. McKinnon. We are talking about his latest book, The Day the World Stopped Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. I did not know that Finland experienced a pretty severe fall during the early 1990s. How did people adapt to that?
Finland was an unusual situation because they have a really unified culture, and they also have, you know, quite a strongly social democratic government structure. So they taxed the wealthy, they distributed wealth. Maybe more than anything else, what you saw in Finland was a certain amount of relief from the direction that things had been going. So at the time that the Great Finnish Depression struck in the 1990s, Finland had just gone through the same kind of boom as a lot of places in the West saw in the 80s. They had yuppie culture, they had the greed is good mentality starting to build in Finland, and that was historically brand new in that country. It had been a really strongly social democratic country up to that point. The 1990s saw relief from that and a return to a sense of greater equality between individual Finns. They weathered the storm without, as people pointed out, without riots, without mass protests. They buckled down, shared what they had to some extent and through the government, and they got through it.
Kind of reminds me of what people did in Iceland, too. On another topic, talk to us about the links between shopping and the night sky. I never considered this until I read your book.
Yeah, this is one of the quirkier aspects when I started looking into, well, what happens if we suddenly stop consuming so much? One of the things that came out of the research was that the world starts to get dimmer. So I had not realized that there's a fairly fixed percentage. I can't recall exactly what it is right now, but there's a fairly fixed percentage of the GDP of any nation that gets spent on lighting. So when degrowth occurs, the overall brightness of a society actually starts to dim. That can be quite beneficial. I mean, we have quite a few problems with light pollution, and of course, lights burn energy. So it raised that question, you know, would we be comfortable living in a somewhat darker world? Is that the kind of shift in consumption that we would be able to welcome? And I think the upside, of course, is that you do end up with wonderful night skies. You end up with much less light pollution. And the only real downside seems to be that we're anxious about adapting to a little bit more darkness. But there's great variety in the cities around the world in terms of how bright or how dim they are. And so I visited Berlin, which is one of the dimmer of the large cities. And I thought it was a wonderful place to visit at night. People sitting in darkened parks, dimmer streets than we see in a lot of cities around the world. Personally, I found it soothing and pleasant, and it was wonderful to be able to stand in the middle of a big city and see, you know, two or three times more stars than I do here in Vancouver.
Are you aware of the Reverend Billy Talon and the Church of Stop Shopping?
You bet I am, yeah.
Well, he's kind of a hero, but I think that in some of his actions, I mean, at one point he was standing in a mall with a bullhorn telling people to stop shopping as sort of a religious sermon, and he was arrested and taken away in handcuffs. So I started thinking about all the ways that the big system that you just described earlier will coerce us and fight off any anti-consumerism, trying to suppress it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, it really is. Part of the reason that I started working on this book is because as a topic, consumption and consumerism had really fallen by the wayside. I mean, I really hadn't seen it at the center of discussions around sustainability since the 1990s. And that didn't make any sense to me, given that consumption is not only now the biggest driver of environmental crises, but it's getting worse all the time. You know, some of the conversations I had as I tried to reach out to larger corporations and see how they respond to the idea that maybe they should be addressing sustainability by simply encouraging people to reduce their consumption. And some of those conversations became almost cloak and dagger. I mean, within the larger corporations of the world, they really do not want to talk about this subject. And it was a frightening topic for some people to approach, to the extent that they, you know, many people were either unwilling to talk to me or certainly not willing to talk to me on the record. But at the same time, I did find, you know, a lot of people are thinking about these things and a lot of people are recognizing the nature of this problem. We need to break it up back out into the open and put it at the center of our conversations again.
And meanwhile, the web seems to work against us. If I look at a bird bath and decide, well, I don't need a bird bath, so I'm not going to buy one of those, I get hunted for days, maybe weeks, by little pictures of bird baths everywhere I go. How can we change that? Should we be going to Facebook and to Twitter and Instagram and say, you have a part to play in the wrecking of the world. Are you going to change the rule somewhat?
These are the kinds of issues that we should be looking at, right? We should be able to opt out of these sorts of things. And if it means that we need to move towards models that are advertising free, and that means that we have to pay more for the information that we access, then that's part of the discussion. But we certainly should be able to opt out of advertising that targets us in the way you described so well. You know, these bird baths and pairs of pants and skis and things like this that pursue us through the internet, those are directly trying to overcome what is supposed to be a good consumer habit, which is you feel that impulse to buy something and you give yourself a little time to see whether or not you really, really want to buy it. That's the kind of impulse that helps us draw down consumption. And here we have big business and big tech specifically targeting that weakness and trying to break it down. So it is exactly the kind of thing that we want to look at regulating in some way.
Well, we learn a ton by looking at what would happen the day the world stopped shopping. It's hard to imagine that it will happen anytime soon. Maybe it will take decades. Maybe we need a time for withdrawal, or maybe we will have a revolution when people finally figure out what's killing the planet. What are your thoughts? How is this going to go forward?
Yeah, I mean, the day the world stops shopping is a thought experiment in my book, right? In order to sort of see how we can get past this dilemma we're in, where we need to stop shopping for the sake of the planet, and yet we seem to have to keep shopping for the sake of the economy, I wanted to try this thought experiment where we just, I just on the page make stopping shop and see how it plays out over the coming days, weeks, decades, even centuries. And the way to think about it is not that we're aiming for some kind of moment when we all put our wallets away and never buy another unnecessary thing again, but rather that we start to think about a gradual change in the system towards a system that encourages more durable products and repairable products, that builds the true cost of social and environmental injuries into the prices of the products that we buy in the same manner that carbon taxes are starting to do today. We can change our cities so that there's more things that we can do in the cities that are not consumptive. We can draw down inequality, because inequality is a big driver of consumption. So I think we're looking at more of, it can start tomorrow, but it will play out over years in the same way that the green technology or the digital technology revolutions played out. We didn't expect those things to happen overnight, and a shift to a deconsumer society doesn't happen overnight either. It's work at every level and in every corner of society and culture.
I mentioned you were a journalist. I find your work all over the place. You also teach writing at the University of British Columbia. I'm interested in your process. It seems like it's a personal one. Your 100-mile diet was certainly personal. This book sounds pretty personal, the way you approached it. Is it organic? Do you know what the next thing that's going to bubble out of you will be? Are you working on something now?
I'm always working on something. I mean, at this point, I've shifted back to working on some magazine-length pieces. But I usually have a bunch of book ideas tucked away in my in my head. And when I finish one project, I kind of reach inside and look for one that I think is going to fascinate me and engage me at the level that it really has to write a book, because it's a long process putting these things together. And this one was especially gratifying, I think, because I wasn't sure that there was a lot new to say about consumption. I mean, we've had people throughout history saying we need to consume less, we need to be less materialist, we need to shop less. I wasn't totally sure that there would be something new to say about it. But when I went out and really looked at, well, what might be involved in creating a lower consuming world, then I found all these interesting people and exciting case studies from history and really great stories to tell that illuminate what could be that the path towards that de-consumer society.
Yes, you just got me thinking about a lot of history. There have been the Christian sects who renounced materialism and lived with less, and of course in Asian cultures, in the Hindu religions, we find people who are doing that, some in Buddhism. There's been a struggle to try and rearrange ourselves according to the physical world that we live in. I think your book is part of that. It's part of self-discovery in a big way.
I think so. I mean, I think what people who read this book will, I think they'll be entertained. I mean, the thought experiment was fun to do. It was fun to take the world and make the shopping stop and see what plays out. That was an enjoyable experience. But what comes out of it are these deeper themes of change at every level, from the kind of choice we make when we set out to buy a product that we need to the way we orient our values and what priorities we put at the center of our lives. And, you know, it was really fascinating encountering, for example, people in Namibia whose cultural practice for literally tens of thousands of years has been to live with very, very few possessions, and to meet and speak with those people and get a sense of, well, and really just to observe how deeply satisfying their lives appear to be. I mean, certainly as satisfying and as rich and fulfilling as our lives, and I think in some ways more so.
And those people could have gone and gotten more and stashed it away any time and did not. And that goes against everything that's holy as a Canadian. We're always banking up stuff for the next winter and maybe for our retirement 50 years away. It's a different concept of time. And I wonder if the Namibians were more living in the present than we are able to do. We'll have to call it there. Go find The Day the World Stopped Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. We all need it more than we know. James, maybe people will buy your book and then decide to stop buying books. Then what?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a good start. But yeah, I mean, the book is not saying nobody should ever buy anything ever. I like to think that if people are buying fewer, better things, then I hope I've written a better book, something that's going to feel worth it for people to own and read. And of course, there's always the library.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.